on this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we begin with the conversation of the late, great Ricky Henderson, who passed away at the age of 65 over the weekend. We discuss his legacy as one of the greatest entertainers and, of course, greatest players to ever play our beloved game. And then we have a whole bunch of transactions to get to. Many first basemen were on the move via free agency, via trade. We're going to get to all of that, as well as the Phillies finally making some moves and throw it into turbo mode for some bonus transactions at the end of this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that tacked up its first $1 million check on the wall so we could remind ourselves that we are millionaires. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. That's not a real story about us. It is about Ricky Henderson.
Ricky Henderson will, of course, be our first topic on this absolutely loaded Monday edition of Baseball Barbacast. If you are watching on YouTube, you can see Jake and I are in very different places as Jake continues his excursions in Southeast Asia. You have made it to Thailand. I have continued my excursions in the great state of Ohio. I am in the basement of my lovely in-laws' house. Jake, you are not in a basement, quite the opposite. Seems like you're having a good time, and I appreciate you hopping on to do this pod with me.
I'm having a stellar time, Jordan, and I'm ready to roll through it.
And before we start, as I mentioned, of course, we are going to start with Ricky Henderson, one of the greatest baseball players of all time, who sadly passed away over the weekend. It is important, too, Jacob, you're not going to be on here for at least another week or so. So this is going to be good. The baseball world gave us a lot to talk about for this episode, and I'm excited that we'll get to do it together.
Who's on first? We're going to tell you. But let's begin with Ricky, who passed away at the age of 65 over the weekend. And the headline for him is simple. He is one of the greatest baseball players of all time. For as famous and as renowned as he was, the numbers back up his unique contributions to the sport, perhaps even more or just as much as the aura around the person.
Yeah, which is pretty hard to fathom. And I think, obviously, when we have talked about legends who have passed away on this show, many of whom, of course, we had Willie Mays earlier this year, ones who we didn't necessarily see play, there's only, you know, so much we can read and watch and listen to and experience that isn't necessarily going to compare to the ones who actually did go see Ricky play in person or got to know him and cover him. And you can hear those perspectives all over the place. But I will say, I think what's so cool about Ricky, because he did play for so long and he did play into the 21st century, this is someone, and you wrote a little bit about this, we both wrote about Ricky over the weekend. He is a mythical figure, and yet he's also so incredibly human. You know, we do have a lot of mythical figures over the course of baseball history that, especially those who played, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 years ago, where you're like, I can't even, like, Babe Ruth is like hard to fathom. You can't even really relate to any of it. You know, like, it's just like, I look at his numbers and I'm like, all right, like, I trust that happened, but it's hard to really feel anything about it. Whereas Ricky, even though, of course, the career starts in the 80s, spans to 2003, because he stuck around after his career to impact so many people that were still around the game to the point where we even, you know, got to interview him at the celebrity softball game in 2018. Like, he has impacted so many people, and he is such a real thing that I believe everything about it because he was so legit and so unbelievably talented. And I think that combination of somehow being larger than life and also incredibly relatable is unique. And that is my big picture. When I started to kind of process what Ricky meant to the sport, that's kind of where I landed. But obviously, there are a lot of different directions you could go.
His rookie year, Don Baylor was the MVP, and his final year, Alex Rodriguez was the MVP. Okay, like, it 1979 to 2003 is, yeah, preposterous. My first memory of Ricky Henderson just existing, I was a big Stratomatic kid, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the first year I played was 2003. And I remember looking at this card and being like, this guy sucks. Why is there a 44-year-old on the Dodgers? This card sucks. And I remember having to have it explained to me by my dad. Like, no, that's just Ricky Henderson. Like, yes, he's still playing. And I think that I loved the tidbit that came up in a lot of the obits, which was that he never really retired. The phone calls just stopped coming. Right. And when I think about Manny Ramirez, this is someone who we can relate, a player who just loved it so much that they never wanted to stop. That many people would have hung it up at 39 or 41. But for Ricky, being around the game was his life. And he was so fulfilled and enamored by being a player that he just squeezed every last drop out of the experience.
Well, and part of that is because he was so otherworldly talented, right? I mean, you don't right. get those opportunities over and over if you're not still being a well above average hitter at age, you know, 40, the way he was with the Mets in 1999. And I think that's what's so cool, right? He only plays for the A's and the Yankees for the first 14 years of his career. And at that point, like if he had played a couple more years and stuck with Oakland and retired and was obviously a Hall of Famer, like that is an amazing career. He's an all-time great. All those things could be said. And Oakland, which is still, of course, the place we will always associate him with, not, you know, seven other teams would have the opportunity to be impacted by Ricky Henderson the way that ultimately they were. And so it's so cool that, you know, over this last day or so, we've seen so many different teams and players and people from these all these other organizations, whether it's Toronto or San Diego or the Mets, right? Or even the Dodgers at the end, where it's like, we got to have Ricky Henderson on our team. And that is an amazing thing that was only possible because he was so talented and was able to stick around and be a good baseball player for that long. But I think that is also what is unique about him relative to some of the other players we've talked about recently, whether it's Willie Mays or even, you know, Pete Rose or some of the other players who, you know, of course, there's something special about having that one connection. And he does also have that with Oakland. But to have those experiences in so many different other cities and impact so many different other teams is also, I think, really cool.
Yeah, it is kind of the best of both worlds there. So he leaves Oakland for the second to last time after the 1995 season, joining the Padres in 96 as a 37-year-old, and then proceeds to put up 9.4 WAR over the rest of his career, right? Like, that's pretty impressive as a guy who's 37 years old. And you can't boil down this guy into wins above replacement. I understand that. But when you go position player wins above replacement, post-integration, which is an important caveat, he's fifth. Okay, he's fifth behind Bonds, Mays, Aaron, A-Rod. We're the most lenient when it comes to the juice, but there's an argument that he could be third on that list. This is not a great baseball player. It is simply one of the greatest baseball players of all time.
And that's the other thing too, right? Obviously, I focused on the stolen bases in what I wrote because they are totals that will always be just unfathomable to look at. And even as the league tries to get stolen bases back into the game, you can do whatever kind of math problem you want. It is still virtually impossible to imagine anyone even approaching the original record, which was, you know, passing Lou Brock at 939. It's laughable. I mean, it's a completely different level of thing. And yet, like I said before, like, it's very real. It's very tangible. It's not Babe Ruth hitting 60 home runs and the rest of the league hitting 10, right? He was doing this on color television. And so we have all these awesome highlights, and we have what is also most important, and I think maybe a good note to kind of finish on, because again, we could do a whole episode on Ricky, but as you know, if you listen to this, there's a lot of transactions that we're going to get to, and we encourage you to go read a million different Ricky, you know, tributes all across the internet over the last few years.
Start with the Howard Bryant book. I'll just say that.
Yes.
It's incredible.
Right. And I know Howard and I believe Jeff also, you know, wrote a little bit more about Ricky over the last couple of days. But I would just say that, you know, this is a career, and this person is the other part of it too, right? Like, if this baseball reference page was what it was, and he was just a very generic, nothing, you know, average ball player over these 25 years, then that would also be amazing, and we would be talking about him on this podcast. but that he had these numbers and then decided to also be one of the most entertaining humans, let alone players on the field, is an added treat. And I think part of also why he, you know, left such a, made such an impact on so many people that he came across.
I wrote about this, but he understood that this was entertainment. He understood he was a character in a play. But at the same time, he wasn't playing a character. Sure, he was hamming it up at times, referring to himself in the third person, but it never came across as manufactured, is my understanding. Yeah. It all came across as pretty authentic. And the two other takeaways I had in kind of digging into Ricky, one was that the amount of fighting he did for player contracts, obviously for his own money, was significant. Like, it felt like every spring training he was doing a contract holdout, you know? And this is an era where money is just flowing into the sport and no one really knows how to deal with it. And Ricky's like, in 1991, he enters spring training as the 40th best or 40th highest paid player in baseball. And he's like, I'm not the 40th best player. Like, pay me. Now, I don't think the A's did, but like, he was willing to say those things out loud in a way that even now we don't really get that. You know, the example would, in my mind, would be Bryce Harper wanting more money and then funneling that through Scott Boras and not Bryce Harper going to the microphone and saying, I should be paid more money. Now, we can have a conversation about what is more effective, but I do think that Ricky as a character made that, it was incredibly compelling for people, I would imagine.
Yeah, 100%. And obviously those decisions sometimes did lead to him changing teams, and that's part of his story too. But like I said before, I think you wouldn't want to change anything about that. And I think that that's part of the Ricky story.
One more point. He was so cool.
Like, I know.
He was so cool. Like, when you go back and watch some of the highlights of that, he's so cool. He's so before his time. Like, the neon green batting gloves and just the way he flowed across a baseball field, celebrating home runs, admiring his handiwork. The chain, you know, he had a chain that had the number 130 in diamonds on it because that's how many bases he stole the year he broke the record. Like, it's just this level of panache that feels both before its time and of its time at the same time.
Yeah.
And I want more players today to channel some of that. Now, we see it more than ever than we've had, right? Players feeling comfortable being themselves in the field. Ricky's a huge part of that, man. A huge part of that. Deserves a lot of credit for pushing the game forward in a good way while also taking a lot of the flack. And that kind of ties into, you know, being a loud black man in America and fielding all of the bad that comes along with that. And then I guess really we should mention Oakland.
Yeah. That's I would say that is a good note to end on, just because, I mean, again, you know, we've talked about the timings of some of these legends passing away, right? With Willie Mays earlier this year, with the Rickwood game, with Fernando Valenzuela before the World Series. But this the last few years, we've spent so much time talking about Oakland and what baseball in Oakland has meant. I mean, look, it wasn't Ricky Henderson Field by accident, right? And that is part of it that makes this extra heartbreaking. Obviously, this is, if Oakland baseball was thriving, this would still be devastating because he is Oakland baseball. But that is also part of it that makes this all the more difficult, that because he stayed all the way to the very end. He was there. And he never, at no point did he turn his back on an organization that had obviously made a lot of people really angry. And you can understand that because of what that organization meant to him. But it's an added layer to this that is pretty difficult to process.
He was from Oakland, he was of Oakland, and he was for Oakland. I remember when I asked Rob Manfred at a press conference at the beginning of the season what the league's plans were to serve the community of the East Bay now that professional baseball was going to leave, and he had a bad answer about going to see the Giants. This is a part of that story. The amount of talent that came out of Oakland in the 50s, 60s, and 70s is mind-boggling. Ricky, Curt Flood, Vada Pinson, Joe Morgan, Frank Robinson, Gary Pettis. It's really something, and it saddens me that, you know, baseball in a place will presumably mean less moving forward. But that is by no fault of the one and only Ricky Henderson. Let's take a quick break, and when we get back, we will pivot to first base. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. What's on second? No. Who's on first?
A lot of different players on a lot of different teams, Jake. We are recording this on Sunday evening. On Friday morning, I woke up planning to write some words about Pete Alonso, because the first base market appeared to be completely frozen. And it was like, man, like, Pete's kind of the face of this. Like, what's going on? And, you know, a little more than a couple days later, we've got, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different first basemen on the move. And Pete Alonso is not one of them. So while the market has certainly picked up, Pete will not be a main topic on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Instead, we will begin with the, oh, maybe this guy's actually just better than Pete Alonso, Christian Walker. We are going to go chronologically because I think it is important. All of these moves are interrelated because this position was, again, it was stuck. A lot of teams needed first baseman. A lot of teams could have gone a lot of different directions. And clearly, once the Houston Astros gave Christian Walker a 3-year, $60 million deal, we started to get some movement. So let's start with Walker going to Houston, Jake. As I just mentioned, $60 million for him over 3 years. If that contract sounds familiar, that's because it's nearly identical to the one that they gave Jose Abreu a couple of winters ago. Now, why am I bringing that up now? That deal going so poorly is why the Astros still need a first baseman. And they still owe Jose Abreu, who they released earlier this year, roughly $20 million in 2025. But as we know, they are still firmly in their competitive window. They still view themselves as World Series contenders. And because of that, they needed to go address first base. We had the rumors about Nolan Arenado potentially being traded there. He blocked that possibility. And so the Astros weren't going to wait around. They decided to move on from Bregman. They already had Isak Paredes. And so they signed Christian Walker to this deal. And it is a very, very snug fit. And I think there's a lot of reasons why you could look at the Abreu deal and be like, oh, another mid-30s first baseman. He's going to fall off the cliff too. But there's a lot more reasons to be optimistic about Walker. Obviously, he's a way better defender, arguably the best first base defender in the league. He's 2 years younger than Abreu was when he signed. And the offensive, you know, underlying stuff just looks a lot more promising for him moving forward. So the fit is very obvious, but I think that this move means a lot. It certainly impacted a lot of movement over the rest of the weekend. But this is a very, very significant move here, because this really does mark the end of Alex Bregman in Houston.
We need to separate the move from the player. I like Christian Walker. I think he is good. I think he will help the Astros. This transaction signals the end of an era. And that might sound dramatic, and it is, but it is also true. Houston opting to let two homegrown stars, cornerstones of this era, leave, Kyle Tucker via trade, and presumably now Alex Bregman via free agency, is a decision brought about by mismanagement, by poor contracts given out, and is an unfortunate way for this stretch, this historic stretch of Houston baseball, to end. Now, the Astros will still be a competitive team. They will still probably make the playoffs because they're the Astros. But it's a different thing now without Bregman. More than without Tucker, who might be a better player right now, but Bregman really came to encapsulate what this was all about. The good, the bad, the frustrating, the unapologetic, the annoying, and the dominant. He was all of that. And by signing Walker, there is now the implication he will play first base. Isak Paredes, who they traded for in the Tucker deal, will play third. Their payroll is probably right about where they want it to be. And I just think the reluctance from ownership to spend on any of these meaningful players is a fascinating way to do business.
Yeah, and obviously they've made the decisions to extend Altuve for a significant number for a mid-30s second baseman, and they did extend Yordan for a deal that obviously looks tremendous, and he's still slated to reach free agency at a deal where he could still cash in again, and that's a few years off. But no, I totally agree with you. I mean, it is, you know, if Abreu is not a disaster, they are likely in a better position right now to keep Tucker, and maybe they do still bring in Paredes and they trade Tucker. You know, maybe it wasn't likely that they were going to keep all of these guys together, and we understand that. But ultimately, like, when you look at the team right now, can you really say they're better with Walker and Paredes than with Tucker and Bregman? I would say no. I mean, there's parts you could argue that, sure, right, Walker's obviously an upgraded first base, but great, now you have a Gold Glove first baseman instead of a Gold Glove third baseman and arguably a Gold Glove right fielder. And that's my last point on this move before we move to Paul Goldschmidt, which is basically,
now what?
Are you done, Houston? Because your outfield right now is not exactly looking like that of a contender, right? Jake Myers is a hell of a defender in center. Chaz McCormick was just a disaster offensively this past season. And then Joe Espada talked to the winter meetings about how he really doesn't want Yordan Alvarez playing a lot of the outfield anymore. And so I'm sure he will still get a little bit of time in left field, but if he's your primary DH, which is fine because he's one of the best hitters in the world, like, this outfield is really unsettled, and I think if they can bring in another outfielder, if they're willing to make that move, now we can start having a conversation where it's like, all right, maybe this lineup is a little bit better. But right now, it just looks very different, and I still credit them for going out and getting Christian Walker because I think he's good and I think he'll help them. And obviously, Paredes, I think, could be a good fit there, but it's quite a different look. And as long as Altuve's there, it'll still feel like the Astros to some degree. But all of his friends are gone.
He is Will Smith alone in the room with Yordan Alvarez. But
good guy. I guess, good guy to have around.
And I guess Lance McCullers is like in the bathroom.
He's maybe coming back. And that's the last thing on Altuve. Altuve was very vocal about how badly he wanted Bregman back, right? Yeah. And yeah, of course. And sure, you could say, oh, well, everybody says that about the guys that are leaving free agency. I felt like Altuve had taken it to another level, and now that's not going to happen. So it doesn't mean Altuve's, you know, going to be miserable and hate the Astros forever. It's just, I think that's interesting. So anyway.
From the Astros to the team that hates them the most, the New York Yankees sign Paul Goldschmidt, 1 year, $12 million. What does this mean for their alignment? Paul Goldschmidt is going to play first base. Duh. Cody Bellinger, who they just traded for, is now almost exclusively going to play outfield, either center or left, with Jason Dominguez roaming the other pasture. And I think it is just a fascinating add. Now, it's also not that complicated. When the Yankees signed Max Fried, they gave up two picks for compensation. I believe it was the second round and the fifth round for Fried. If they had signed another free agent that had the qualifying offer attached, they would have had to give up picks in the third round and the sixth round. And giving up four picks in the top six rounds essentially bazookas your entire draft into dust. And it was clear the Yankees weren't willing to do that. And so if you take out the two first basemen who got qualifying offers, Christian Walker and Pete Alonso, the presumption is that the Yankees just thought Goldschmidt was the best or the best value of the rest of that group. And so they bring him in to play first.
Right, because they clearly still had money to spend. And so we're going to get to some first base trades here in a little bit, but they decided that Goldschmidt at $12 million is someone that they believed in that could make it better. Now, there are still questions about the rest of this lineup because the rest of the infield is still unsettled, and we don't really know what Cody Bellinger is as a hitter, let alone Dominguez. But the reality is that first base, if you just focus on first base, this has been a bad situation for the Yankees for the last couple of years, as Anthony Rizzo has declined, particularly this past year. And I think even an average version of Goldschmidt is an upgrade at that spot. And I think he fits in well in that sense. Now, what are you actually getting there when we are talking about, you know, a 37-year-old guy who had started to look closer to Cook than you would like to see for someone who won an MVP in 2022? I'm fairly optimistic. I don't think he's going to totally fall off a cliff, but also, listen, it's a 1-year, $12 million deal. Like that's not like a ringing endorsement that this guy's about to bounce back and become an all-star. It's just that he can be a useful, good hitter. And I'm sure he was probably, I can imagine Paul Goldschmidt was excited about the possibility of being a Yankee as well.
Going to be weird to see him clean shaven.
Yeah, but he's always had kind of like, it's not like it's been bushy, but he's always had something, right?
Always.
He's never been really smooth, but he's not one. Whereas with Max Fried, it's like, okay, now you look like you're in middle school. I don't think Paul Goldschmidt's going to look like he's in middle school.
His addition doesn't make me feel great about the Yankees lineup still. Like he and Bellinger and Jazz and Stanton all have impressive upside. But boy, the floor could fall out on all of them, man. Like it could get ugly. And I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but I find that when we grade transactions, often it's like, this is a good ad. This fits well. This is going to be great. And then we look back on deals, there's so many more misses than we think. And this just smells like I don't know.
I don't totally disagree with you. I think again, as we kind of spin this forward as to what happens next here, that's the thing. We said it after Bellinger, and I'll still say it now after Goldschmidt, is there's still more work to do. I think Jazz is such an interesting part of this conversation.
Yeah.
The fact that he showed, not just the fact that he showed he could play third and thus they have the flexibility to chase a second baseman or a third baseman, but you also have to imagine that like, they're counting on him to be an impact bat as well, that we did see at times, and at times he looked like not that, right? And I think that volatility is going to remain with him. But he's a big part of that lineup too, not just the fact that he can bounce between positions. And so that I think puts a lot of pressure on him for sure, but I still think there is another additional move for them offensively. Let's also just take a couple minutes here quickly to mention the other move that they made, which is they traded Jose Trevino, their backup catcher, to the Cincinnati Reds. Now, this was maybe a little bit more interesting from the Cincinnati side. Trevino only has a year remaining on his deal. The Reds really wanted a defense-first backup catcher to pair with Tyler Stevenson, who really had a good season this past year. And Trevino fits there. The Yankees acquire Fernando Cruz, a guy who has huge strikeout upside, awesome splitter, not really good at anything else, doesn't throw strikes, fastball's not good, slider's not good. Awesome person, having been around Fernando Cruz in Cincinnati. Like, I'm a big fan of him. I'm definitely rooting for him. Like, he's a great dude who kind of broke out very late in his career, which is why he has 4 years of team control, even though he's 35. Like, it's a very interesting career arc. That splitter is very special. He comes with some risk too, but obviously they're still trying to backfill the bullpen, and I can see what they're going for there with Cruz. I do wonder what the plan at backup catcher is with the Yankees. That's not the number one concern, but you know, they traded away another depth piece in Carlos Narvaez to Boston. They get Alex Jackson back in this trade. The fact that he's still bouncing around is kind of amazing. Is Ben Rice a catcher now? Like, I just can't believe that Alex Jackson is plan A as the backup catcher. Otherwise, are we really going to have Austin Wells catch like 140 games? That also seems like maybe not the best idea. Not that he's not a good catcher, but that guy already looked tired enough at the end of last postseason.
Oh my God.
And I feel like he could use, like, there was a purpose for Trevino, especially in the regular season. And so I'm curious where New York goes from there. That obviously doesn't impact the lineup as much, but I think that is an interesting part that is going to still probably have to be addressed for the Yankees.
Yankees with 5 MVPs in their starting lineup. Stanton, Judge, Bellinger, Goldschmidt, Anthony Volpe, 2019 perfect game, New Jersey Player of the Year.
Can't take that away from him. That is the latest on the New York Yankees. And okay, so now Goldschmidt gets signed. Now it's like, all right, the Yankees don't need a first baseman. But there are still teams that do need a first baseman, including the Arizona Diamondbacks. Oh, right. Christian Walker left the desert. And we hadn't even mentioned what that could mean for the Diamondbacks. And that's because we get to talk about it now. Because Arizona swung a deal with the Cleveland Guardians, staying busy. Oh boy, those Gardos are keeping things interesting. For Josh Naylor, first baseman, who's been in Cleveland since 2020 and has been, of course, a huge part of the Guardians, I mean, one of the faces of the Guardians, you know, in the non-Jose Ramirez category, he has become one of the more recognizable players on this roster over the last few years. But with the year remaining on his contract, it was not surprising. And where you looked at kind of how their system was shaking out with Kyle Manzardo coming up, you saw Cleveland said, and you said, okay, it would not surprise us if they traded Josh Naylor this winter and decided to address first base in another way or use the money else in another way. And so they trade him to Arizona, who, of course, had to replace Christian Walker. They don't just have to replace Christian Walker, right? Jock Peterson and Randall Grichuk, big parts of that offense that are also free agents right now. And this is it's not surprising that as soon as Christian Walker was out the door, I don't know how close they were to bringing him back, that they had to address this hole pretty quickly, and they do so with getting Naylor.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. D-backs needed a first baseman. Naylor is a slightly above average one, and he'll fit in decently well in the desert. I think this deal is fascinating from a Cleveland perspective because they go ahead and use the $12 million that Naylor was projected to get in arbitration, and they just give it to Carlos Santana. And just quickly from a PR perspective, genius move, because Santana, obviously a longtime member of that organization, played there for a while. If the headline was Guardians trade away Josh Naylor for comp pick and reliever who they could maybe fix, if I'm a fan, I'm frustrated by that. But if you tell me right away that you're also bringing Santana back, I am not mad. Like, I'm not mad at all. And it's interesting to note the Santana deal's not finalized. The Naylor deal went public, like, right, or went official, like, right away. And so my sense is that the Guardians just kind of leaked the Santana thing to go along with the Naylor news so that the fans wouldn't be frustrated, which is good stuff. Good job.
Yeah. And listen, when Chris Antonetti spoke to the you know, Cleveland beat, which I'm now, since I'm in the Cleveland BBWA, I hopped on that Zoom call on Sunday morning and I was like, hey, tell me about Slade Ciccone. But really it was like, okay, like, when does this come together? And he did say, like, of course, the first base market is moving. But once they realized that they had an opportunity to replace Josh Naylor with something they felt really good about, a.k.a. Carlos Santana, even though it's not official yet. And because of that, Antonetti had to, like, do the goofy talking around it, even though we all know it was going to happen. I mean, he basically acknowledged it was going to, it could become official here at some point here soon. But I agree with you. The timing did not feel like a coincidence. It felt like if once they felt, and by the way, Carlos Santana already, like, posted on Instagram, like, excited to be home. I mean, if there's any, you know, if there's a Dominican that loves Cleveland more than Jose Ramirez, it's Carlos Santana. I mean, these guys have just absolutely loved playing for this organization. And this is going to be Santana's third stint with the Guardians, which is pretty amazing. And yeah, I mean, if you look at overall value, when you consider Santana's incredibly improved defense, the fact that he's still an excellent on-base ability, he has some of the power actually returned this past year. And this is a guy who's going to turn 39 in April. Like, sure, if we're talking about just one more year for next year, Santana versus Naylor, again, he's 10 years older, so maybe he falls off a cliff too, but you can understand that. And then they did get things here that they do value, right? I mean, that draft pick is in the late 70s. You know, I'm not going to spend too much time on that, but Ciccone is important here. I mean, he kind of ended up lost in the shuffle in Arizona because they had so many veteran arms ahead of him, but this is a former first round pick. This is someone who has moved to the bullpen kind of out of necessity. But this is someone I would not be surprised at all if they're going to give him a chance to start. He'd been a starter all the way up through the minors and, you know, a guy who obviously can be a big part of their future. So he's very different than Luis Ortiz, who finished this past season. Like, okay, that guy's in the rotation, right? Like, we feel good about what he's going to get. Like, Ciccone, there's still some question marks, but there's talent there and still a lot of years ahead of him to where he could be a big part of that rotation. And they clearly needed to address the pitching depth in some real way. And knowing Bieber's not going to help until later in the season, I think Ciccone is a very important part of this deal. And he is going to be one of the most important pitchers to kind of watch in spring training this year. But I agree with you. The big takeaway here is the PR sequence was pretty well done, all things considered.
Masterful. This flurry of transactions is what I would describe as a nice bit of business.
Yes. And the last thing I'll say about this move, which, again, maybe on the PR side, but of course, when they make these trades, when they trade away Andrés Giménez and they trade away Josh Naylor, who were fan favorites, and we've had versions of these conversations about Tampa Bay, about Milwaukee, and this is just how these organizations operate. And Chris Antonetti made the point today, which you can roll your eyes and you can also say it's true, which is, how did they get Andrés Giménez and Josh Naylor? In trades that people were not particularly happy about. right? Like, that's kind of how they operate, and they've been able to be correct enough to where they can continue to be competitive. I think there are still real questions about this roster, and you could argue they should still be pushing a lot more forward for a team that's in the ALCS, but their track record's pretty good in that sense. And it is quite the choice, though, to part with both of those guys in the same winter, and we'll see how it works out. But I'm excited to have Carlson and Tanda back around. That guy is a low-key Dominican baseball legend and obviously already beloved in Cleveland.
I think Tampa's different than Cleveland and Milwaukee just because Milwaukee paid Yelich.
Yeah, that's Cleveland true. Milwaukee's a little bit different.
Paid Ramirez. Yep. And so the fan bases have the guy. Tampa they paid Wander.
Yeah, they did. But yes, to your point, no, I agree. That's a little bit different. But it's the same kind of conversation of just the sentiment of just like seeing Guardians fans being like, oh, like really? Like I was just starting to love Josh Naylor. He's been here. He's been such an all-star. And it's like, yeah, you obviously just buy as much Jose Ramirez stuff as you want. But other than that, let's not get too comfortable. But hey, they kept Bieber, and that is not a small thing.
All right. Last first base nugget before we take a break. The Nationals acquiring Nathaniel Lowe from the Texas Rangers for left-handed pitcher Robert Garcia. The Nats do something. They, to this point, and even still, for me, had been the most disappointing team so far of the offseason, a club with cash to burn on the brink of being competitive with a young core that needs some support. And they had just been sitting on their hands, even though the Patrick Corbin contract was off the books. They go ahead and swing a deal for Nathaniel Lowe, $10.7 million in arbitration, makes him one of the highest paid Nats immediately, if not the highest paid National other than Steven Strasburg.
That is correct. Assuming, again, the arbitration is just a projection, but I love this. I love this for the Nationals. I sure would love to see them be a little bit more aggressive in free agency, and maybe they will be. We'll talk about the Soroka deal a little bit later, but Davey Martinez was practically begging at the winter meetings, like, we need help at the corner infield spots, and we need veterans. Like, because, I mean, we can make all the jokes about Patrick Corbin we want, but, like, he was important as far as just, like, a veteran to have around that, like, knows what it's like to be a major leaguer. And they had all those guys had essentially departed in recent years. And so not that Nathaniel Lowe has been around for 15 years, but that's a guy who has, you know, was acquired by Texas at the beginning of their rebuild and became a really good player, won a World Series and knows what to do and has been an above average hitter for multiple seasons. He's a great defender at first. He's an awesome dude in the clubhouse, and he's kind of exactly what they need. And the fact that they now have him for 2 years where now we have a chance to really kind of push forward here this year. Again, I still would like to see more investment, and there's still parts of this roster where I'm like, come on. And especially the bullpen right now looks nothing like that of a contender. But you can replace Robert Garcia. Robert Garcia is pretty good. He had a solid year as a left-handed pitcher, and he will help the Texas bullpen, which also needs a lot of help. You know, him and Hobie Milner are going to be holding it down out there. But I love this for the Nats. This isn't really that complicated. I think that they were able to get him for this when you saw what some of these other, like even what Naylor got and what Spencer Horwitz cost. Like, this is a really nice job from Mike Rizzo, who continues to find ways to impress us in kind of goofy ways.
Do you know how many individuals on the Washington Nationals are older than 30?
I think basically none. I mean, none regular. I know it was so two. Funny. David was talking.
There are
okay.
Two.
Yeah, tell me.
Alex Call is 30 and Derek Law is 30. And Nathaniel Lowe will be 30 soon. And so they just, like you said, they needed adults. Lowe is a good fit. Love this deal. A++++. Turtleneck gang, welcome to the nation's capital.
Yeah, so hopefully the Nats keep going forward. As for the Rangers, like, this was interesting because clearly Lowe's been in trade rumors for a while, but even after they traded for Jake Berger, it was like, they don't need to. Like, Berger can just DH. Like, this lineup looks pretty good now. They decide to trade him, and now it's a matter of probably reinvesting that money. You know, Evan Grant, the Rangers beat writer, already, you know, reporting that like they will take that, you know, $10 to $12 million and probably bring in a free agent hitter, and who that is will probably determine how much more we like that lineup moving forward.
It's Jock.
So, you know,
it's going to be Jock.
Jock is so perfect. Jock is like painfully perfect for them. I mean, there are a lot of teams that should absolutely have signed Jock by now, but he makes so much sense there for a billion reasons. And even if he's just DHing, you know, you probably don't even need him to play the outfield. Remember, Jock Peterson played zero innings in the outfield in 2024. I know that was just as much about Arizona as it was about Jock, but he fits perfectly there. We'll see if that's what it ends up being. The Rangers definitely have some more work to do. I still am pretty skeptical of their pitching staff, but I sort of get why they did this, and it's a big bet on Garcia, who's a kind of an unknown, as good as he was quietly in 2024, but this is just a great win for the Nats, so good for them.
All right, enough first base. Let's move off a corner, and when we return, we'll talk about the Phillies. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. The Philadelphia Phillies signed Max Kepler a couple days ago for 1 year, $10 million. He's going to play left field. We'll get Brandon Marsh and Johan Rojas in center. Castellanos stays in right. And Dave Dombrowski, in speaking about that move, insinuated that the Phillies were done, that their offseason business was concluded and completed. On our document for the podcast after that, I wrote, Dombrowski is bluffing.
Yep.
Not 48 hours later, the Phillies announced that they acquired left-handed pitcher Jesus Luzardo and catcher Paul McIntosh from the Marlins for a pair of prospects, shortstop Starling Caba and outfielder Amarion Boyd. Dombrowski, I see you.
Why don't you take the Philly side of this, and then we can open up Jordan's prospect hut and talk about Starling Caba. But I think for the Phillies team that has become, again, another team that is just like shockingly quiet this winter, right? There's a few of these that you would imagine, teams that we've been so active, San Diego, Seattle, like nothing. These teams have done nothing. Philadelphia, besides Jordan Romano, was in that bucket too, but it felt like it was only a matter of time. And the Kepler deal, I was like, good, cool, right? Like I like Max Kepler as a bounce back candidate. I mean, again, not his best platform year, but this guy was awesome in 2023. Obviously has dealt with injuries. Kind of amazing that this is the end of him in Minnesota. I mean, dude, this dude, talk about
it. 15 years.
Yeah, we always reference like Jurickson Profar as like a prospect that like we used to talk about when we were first doing this in high school. But like Max Kepler signed as a teenager when we were in high school out of Germany. And we were like, whoa, what a story. And then like 15 more years before he wasn't on the Twins anymore. And like hell of a story, hell of a career. And I like myself. I think he's going to be good for the Phillies. But I think, you know, is there an interesting conversation about just, is there another move for them to make in the outfield there? Maybe, but like that was pretty straightforward. But it always, as you mentioned, it always felt like there was something else. And because there wasn't really any obvious free agent fit, and the Alec Boehm thing continues to be one of the stranger storylines of the offseason, what was Dave Dombrowski going to do? He was going to trade some kids. Like that was always how this was going to end up. And that's what happens here. And they get Jesus Luzardo. So what do you see in Jesus Luzardo, and where does he fit into a rotation that didn't seem to desperately need Jesus Luzardo?
Dave Dombrowski is going to be the president of baseball operations for the Nashville Who's It What's It's by the time Starlin Cava is like reaching arbitration. And so it doesn't really matter for him. And I respect the hell out of that. Luzardo. So now the Phillies have just so many starting pitchers, right? Wheeler, Nola, Christopher Sanchez, who is better than you think, Ranger Suarez, and Jesus Luzardo, with Andrew Painter, arguably the top pitching prospect in the world, set to come up at some point this year. They also have Taijuan Walker.
Oops.
What does this mean for Taijuan Walker? It means that Taijuan Walker, they're going to eat the money, or they're going to, like, I would be surprised if he starts a game for the Phillies this year.
So, right. I mean, injuries could change all of that. I would say the Walker Marcus Stroman parallels are pretty hilarious. Like, which of those players ends up on the team at all? Do they make a start? Whatever. Walker is an expensive, you know, side issue. But okay, they have Jesus Luzardo now. Yeah.
He's amazing when he's healthy. He started game one of the wild card round against the Phillies in 2023 in Philadelphia, after putting together a stupendous season. He is a strikeout machine when he's cooking. Left-handed, hard-throwing, great breaker. Problem is, he's hurt, and he's hurt a lot. He's hurt a lot. The trick will be if they can keep him healthy enough to start a postseason game. And if that's the case, he'll be really good. I think the Phillies simply saw good value in adding him. What it means for the rest of the rotation, I think time will shake that out. The Phillies have been comically fortunate with pitching injuries during the regular season over the last few seasons. And maybe they see that luck coming back to bite them, and adding depth is never a bad thing.
Yeah, no, that's totally valid. I think with Lizardo, it's has some glass now energy, right? Now, he did make 32 full starts in 23, but early in his career too. This isn't just like this past year where he was bad and hurt for most of it. Like, he had a lot of issues coming up, you know, in the minors, and just it took him a while to really establish himself because of all these injuries. But the talent is undeniable. Obviously, as with Glasnow and the Dodgers and some of these other deeper rotations, like, you take a risk like this because you're not relying on him to give you 200 innings, right? It's probably the same calculus as the Dodgers with some of these other pitchers, where it's like, great, if this dude could give us 120, we're cooking, we're looking good. I'm more interested in what it means for Painter than it does for Walker, just because I think it also probably gives him the opportunity to slow play Painter a little bit more. I know a lot of us, because he was on the precipice of making the team 2 years ago, it's like, oh, we got to see this guy now if he's healthy. I think this gives them a little bit more runway to let him go to the minors for the first couple of weeks or months and let him figure it out. Because I have to imagine that if he is healthy, Painter is going to be big league ready at some point this season. Like, that based on how he looked in the fall league, like, that's going to happen. That's a good problem to have. This isn't a reason to not trade for Jesus Luzardo, but Painter's season does become a little bit more interesting.
There's also I think they're just going to try and rest their guys more over the course of the season, like you mentioned how the Dodgers do. Let's boot it up. It's not cold where I am because I'm in Thailand, but I could use some shelter. I'm going to enter Jordan's prospect hut.
Oh, nice. Welcome. Let's talk about Starlin Cava and Amarian Boyd. Let's do Boyd quickly. Again, athletic center fielder. This guy, you know, the stats are not going to wow you. He does have a lot of stolen bases. He does have a pretty decent contact rates. Could be a center fielder, but he's already 21. He hasn't gotten out of A ball yet. He's an athletic flyer. I mean, he's obviously an important part of this deal because they only got two prospects, but this is about Starlin Cava. And Starlin Cava is maybe the best defensive shortstop in the minor leagues. He is a switch hitter. He makes excellent swing decisions and a lot of contact. But right now, he is a skinny, young person. And who am I to tell someone that they are skinny and you know, lack power?
As a skinny old person.
As a skinny old person, much older than Starlin Cava. But when we're talking about prospects and projecting their potential, this is someone who is going to have to add strength if he is going to be an impact player. That's possible because he just turned 19, like last week, and the base skills, which is incredible defensive shortstop and very good switch hitting contact abilities, like, that's a great place to start. And there's a reason why, you know, he's considered a top 100 level prospect by a lot of people's estimates. But what happens next, and the Marlins' ability to prove that they can develop a hitter into a star, Peter Bendix, after the trade, saying like he has all the tools of a superstar, like, that's a big deal, but it's a long way to go and not something that Dave Dombrowski is particularly concerned about. And I can understand why they would trade him. But he does immediately, because he's part of this trade, he absolutely becomes one of the more interesting prospects in 2025 and beyond, even if it is going to take him a while to get to the big leagues.
And he's the best hitting prospect that the Marlins have almost right away. But again, two home runs in his minor league career. That's only like 600 plate appearances, but it's only two home runs. Yeah. Okay. Now what for the Phillies? I think they will get one more reliever. I don't believe you, Dave Dombrowski. But the real question there is, do they really shake it up? They were very vocal about wanting to shake it up. They're like, we would love to have a different look. And then they just haven't done that. Now, if there's a price they like for Marsh or for Bohm, they might pull the trigger on that. They would love to not have to pay Castellanos, I would imagine.
Well, good luck
get with him
that
off the books. But like but I just don't know. They'll keep trying, but at this point, it seems most likely they just get another arm and move forward with that. Anything else?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of mentioned it briefly, like, the bone thing is just bizarre. Like, I don't, maybe it was all nonsense all along, but that is obviously something that is going to be one of the biggest stories when he arrives in spring training. And maybe that's not fair if he does make it to spring training on the Phillies. Like, I just am confused about how that got to where it was and whether they do want him to be there or they don't want him to be there. Like, it's that all of that stuff just still seems a little bit weird to me. And so how that plays out, whether he gets traded or not, I am curious. Not that he is doomed to never be a good player for the Phillies again, but it's just a strange part of what has already been an interesting tenure for him in Philadelphia. So that definitely intrigues me. Are you ready to go fast, Jake Mintz?
Jordan, like Ricky Henderson, I was born fast.
We have 1, 2, 3, wait, sorry, 4,
quickly,
5.
Quickly, oh, on yeah. that. Is the first scene in Ricky Bobby just copying Ricky Henderson's birth?
That's a good point. I don't...
Ricky Henderson, born in the back of an Oldsmobile, was one of the fastest players in baseball history. First scene in Ricky Bobby is the future NASCAR driver born in the backseat of a speeding car.
Mm.
Will Ferrell?
I don't know. Has Ricky Henderson commented on NASCAR on Will Ferrell before? I can't speak to that, but interesting point. Anyway, as I was saying, fair point. No, we fell into that one. We have 7 more moves that we are going to cover in turbo mode, but we are going to be going speedy. Let's begin with 4. Starting pitcher signings. Jake Mintz, the Red Sox signed Patrick Sandoval for 2 years and $18 million. Why does this matter? Patrick Sandoval is probably not going to pitch in 2025 as he had Tommy John surgery this past June, but he was very, very, very good not that long ago. The Angels non-tendered him and the Red Sox were like, I can fix your elbow and then you can pitch for me in 2026. And I kind of like it because I think Patrick Sandoval was looking like he could have been really good. And I feel like hanging out with Andrew Bailey will help him. So nice move, Boston, even if it won't help you in 2025.
The New York Mets sign another former Los Angeles Angel, Griffin Canning, for 1 year, $4.25 million. Canning was traded to the Braves in the Jorge Soler deal, which I had totally forgot about. He is very durable. He sucks up a lot of innings, but he is not good at pitching in those innings. He was one of the worst throwers in baseball in 2024, legitimately terrible. In 2023, he was a lot more usable. If he starts a playoff game for the New York Mets, things have gone to absolute catastrophe. I don't think that will happen. He's just there to sponge up innings. It's not that complicated.
Yes, Clay Holmes Insurance is what I am calling him. The Nationals signed Mike Soroka for $9 million, a 1-year contract. A lot of pieces from smart people. Oh, did you notice how good Mike Soroka was as a reliever for the worst team in baseball history? Oh, wow.
No,
he could be a sneaky target. No, I didn't. Thank you for pointing it out. Wow. Oh, that is a nice strikeout rate. Oh, wow. He could be a good. Oh, some smart team is going to sign Mike Soroka and he's going to be their 8th inning guy. And then the Nationals were like, nah, you could just come start for us. And Mike Soroka was like, yeah, I still want to start. So I'm 27. I don't want to give up on starting at this point. The Nationals needed some rotation reinforcements. This could go terribly. He might just still be a bad starter, but then they could just move him back to the bullpen, and then that would help because now their bullpen is very, very thin. So kind of a weird move, but I'm not going to get mad at the Nationals for spending money for really any reason.
I think it's a super weird move. Odd way to spend $9 million. Rooting for Mike Soroka.
They non-tender Kyle Finnegan, who was projected to make $9 million, and give that to Mike Soroka. Sure. Drewski. Drewski?
Need
Michael
that jersey.
Soroka jersey? Need it. Drewski, all right, let's go away.
Come on the pod and tell us where you get all these jerseys.
Yes, I would love to know that. The White Sox signed Bryce Wilson for $1 million. He will be in their rotation, which is important because he'll probably get traded if he is any good. The A's of Sacramento signed Gio Urshela. They need a third baseman. They said, we need a third baseman. I thought it was going to be Yoan Moncada. But instead, it's Gio Urshela who gets to reunite with his former Yankees teammates, Luis Severino and Miguel Andujar, in Sacramento, California. How exciting.
Just as we all predicted.
Gio Urshela, weird year. I was like, I think Gio Urshela is kind of good. And then he was awful for Detroit and then ended up on the Braves because they needed warm bodies. And then somehow he gets another major league deal. Happy for you, Gio Urshela. Two more moves. The Yankees bring back Jonathan Loaisiga. Johnny Lasagna himself has returned to the Yankees bullpen. Maybe. This guy has been hurt so much. He had one season in, I think it was, what, 2022 or 2021, when he was one of the best relievers in baseball. Since then, he has not thrown very many pitches because his elbow is like, please stop, this hurts. He had some sort of elbow surgery that was reportedly not Tommy John, but we That's probably are not going to see him pitch in the early stages of 2025. But the Yankees still like Johnny Lasagna, and he still likes the Yankees, so he's back with them.
It's always best to have surgeries that people have heard of before. That's what you want. Like, you want an appendectomy or Tommy John. You don't want, like, we don't know what this is.
Well, presumably they knew it was. Maybe an unfair characteristic. The reason I mention this is because the timeline means he could pitch in 2025, maybe, even though he had surgery in April. Whether that's true, who knows? The final move is that the Cincinnati Reds signed Brian Shaw to a minor league contract. This is important because nobody loves Brian Shaw more than new Reds manager Terry Francona. And somehow, some way, this Reds bullpen, which now needs innings after Fernando Cruz was traded, Brian Shaw will find his way back into way too many major league games in 2025. And God bless him for it.
One last nugget of news before we sign off. Will Myers calls it a career. Clap it up for Will Myers. No one's hair more messy. No one's eyes more red. No one's countenance more aloof.
Hey, okay. I'm glad you mentioned this. We don't have to go too long on this. But before Bellinger, yeah. Will Myers was the guy we were like, oh, this guy. What's he been smoking before this MLB Network interview? But let me just say, Will Myers, who ended his career as a very bad player for the Cincinnati Reds in 2023. I had the opportunity to just like hang out in the dugout before games and talk to Will Myers. Delightful. Awesome guy. Like I didn't really know much about him before. Not that people thought he was a bad guy, but him, again, he was a disaster. He was injured. He was not relevant on the Reds. But Will Myers seems like the man, and it's still a pretty damn good career. So clap it up. Maybe he didn't live up to the prospect hype that he once had, but he still played Major League Baseball over 1,000 games. And I hope he sticks around. I would love to run into Will Myers on a ball field at some point in the near future.
Will Myers, come on the pod with Drewski. We'd love to have you both together. Drewski rocking a Will Myers red jersey is perfect.
Oh, the Will Myers Reds jersey. Ooh, Will Myers Red City Connect.
Ooh.
That's our show, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Jake. We'll be back in the new year. This will also be our only show of the week, assuming we don't get any massive news, as we will take a little bit of a break for the holidays, Hanukkah because and Christmas.
It's Drunkenzie Noel's big week.
Yes. But thank you to producer Andrew Hartz for making the show possible. Thank you to Jake's Wi-Fi in the Thai woods for allowing this.
That sounds like a
incredible
pitching prospect.
Ty Woods, yes. Is that I mean, that's not an incorrect assessment of where you are. So
I am in the mountains.
Not to dox you. The mountains. Okay, sorry. Ty Mountain. That's an even better name for a pitching prospect. But thank you, Andrew Hartz. You can email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. We appreciate all the support. And we will be back next week before the new year, but after Christmas, at the end of Hanukkah. That'll be my next show. Jake, we'll see you in 2025, my friend.
I went to a market yesterday in a town of about maybe 2,000 people, and there was a Gary Sanchez Yankee jersey on sale in the market, and I love baseball. Goodbye.